Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute. It's time to begin.
Good evening. Welcome to the Tattered Cover. Thank you for supporting your independent bookstore, and thank you for silencing your cell phones. Beginning with her extraordinary debut novel, The Outlander, Diana Gabaldon has captivated readers with her best-selling saga, featuring 18th-century Scotsman James Frazer and his... 20th-century time-traveling wife, Claire Randall. Now Jamie and Claire have again returned to the 18th century and are facing the inevitable approach of the American Revolution. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to the author of An Echo in the Bone, Diana Gabaldon.
Well, that's something. Usually people, well, I can't say usually, but once in a while people stand up when I stop talking. I seldom have it happen when I start. You know, back in the day when I used to go out and talk to people in the evenings, I'd come back and say to my husband, oh, we had a great crowd. We had 15 people, you know, which was a great crowd for then. I see we've improved the odds a little bit here. Though even then he used to say to me, well, doesn't it make you nervous having to go out and talk to all these total strangers about your book? And I said, well, it might. Save that I've been a university professor for a long time. If I can keep people awake at 8 o'clock in the morning talking about human anatomy and physiology, I can probably keep them awake at 8 o'clock in the evening if they came on purpose to hear me. Though I had my ways even then. I'd walk in the morning to find an auditorium filled with about this many people because human anatomy and physiology was a very popular class. It was a science elective, and everyone took it, including the football team, because they thought it would be easy. And I'd walk in the morning. They were always sitting in the front row, you know, these large inanimate blobs of flesh, sound asleep. I'd walk up to the edge of the platform and say, well, this morning, gentlemen, we're going to discuss the history of contraception. And they'd start blinking. I'd say, in days of old, when knights were bold and condoms not invented, they wrapped old socks around their cocks and babies were prevented. Well, you know, it worked on the football players, too. No, people always say to me, well, how did you get from being a scientist to being a novelist? You know, this seems very peculiar. And I said, well, easy, I wrote a book. You know, that's what you have to do. They don't make you get a license or anything. And now, I'd known since I was about 8 years old that I was meant to write novels. I just didn't know how. I also came from a very conservative family background. My father was fond of saying to me, well, you're such a poor judge of character. You're bound to marry some bum. He said, so be sure you get a good education so you can support your children. So with this going on at home, I thought perhaps I wouldn't announce I wanted to write novels, and instead I went into science. You know, I liked science. I was good at it. My doctoral dissertation was a 400-page opus entitled Nest Site Selection in the Pinion Jay, Gymnorhinus cyanocephalus, or as my husband says, why birds build nests where they do and who cares anyway. But I still wanted to write books. And when I turned 35, I thought to myself, well, you know, Mozart was dead at 36. If you want to write a book, maybe you better get a move on here. And so I said, fine, on my next birthday, I'm going to start writing a book. Because to this point, I had written all kinds of everything, all the stuff you have to write in an academic career, all the stuff that I wrote freelance, because, well, I did not marry a bum. I married a very nice man, to whom I'm still married 37 years later. thank you. You know, I got an email from someone who said, well, I'm trying to get my mother to read the books, but she won't. She just can't think that anybody over 30 can have an engrossing love story. And I wanted to say, how long has your mother been married? But that I refrained. anyway, I said, you know, I've written all this kind of stuff. I had written the freelance stuff because my husband quit work 3 months after our first child was born to start his own business. And I do have to say that in terms of financial stability, there's not much to choose between an entrepreneur and a bum. So I was our sole support for a while. And I had, by a series of accidents, slid sideways into being an expert in scientific computation. It's real easy to be an expert if there's only six people in the world who do what you do. And that was my position. So I had started writing freelance for the computer press for Byte and InfoWorld and PC Magazine and all that. This actually does have something to do with how I got published, by the way. There's a reason I write long books. It's because I like digressions. Anyway, at the time when I decided to start writing a book, I had the equivalent of two full-time jobs and three children under the age of six. I'm not sure why I thought this was the ideal time to begin writing a book, but you know, I did. And so I said, okay, I'm going to start writing a book. So the next question was, what kind of book should I write? It's just for practice. I'm not going to show it to anyone, let alone try to publish it. I just need to know what it takes to write a novel in terms of daily discipline, mental commitment, research, whatever. And so I said, only two rules. I will write the entire book. I won't stop, even if I think it stinks. You know, I won't give up because I need to know what a whole book is like to do. And I will do my absolute best every day in the writing because there's no way of telling whether you're going to be any good or not unless you're doing your best. So I said, okay, that's it. Other than that, no rules. So what kind of book shall I write? Because I read everything and lots of it. And I said, well, I read a lot of mysteries. Maybe I should write a mystery. And I said, no, mysteries have plots. I'm not sure I can do that. And I said, what's the easiest possible kind of book to write for practice? So I thought, well, for me, perhaps that would be a historical novel. As historical novels, you know, have no real genre constraints. You can do anything as long as you have a really believable background that will pull people into the past and make them believe they're there. I said, well, you know, fine. I'm a research professor. I know what to do with a library. It seems easier to look things up than to make them up. And if I turn out to have no imagination, I can steal things from the historical record. So I said, fine, historical novel it is then. So the next question was, where am I going to set this? Because I have no background in history, just the 6 hours of Western civilization they make you take as an undergraduate. And so I said, well, I'm going to have to look up everything anyway. It doesn't really matter. You know, what's a convenient time or place? I was thinking American Civil War, Italian Renaissance, you know, what seems appealing. Well, in this malleable frame of mind, I happened to see a really old Doctor Who episode on public television. I see some of you are familiar with Doctor Who. For the people who are not giggling, Doctor Who is a really old, really long-running show that's produced in the UK, where it is done as a science fiction show for children. In the US, of course, it's a cult, and we have Doctor Who conventions and the like. But the premise of the show is that the Doctor of the title is a Time Lord from the planet Gallifrey, and he travels through space and time having adventures. And along the way, he picks up companions from different periods of Earth's history. Well, in this really old show, which has to have been done 40 years ago at least, he had picked up a young Scotsman from 1745. And this was a 17, 18-year-old boy who appeared in his kilt. And I said, well, that's fetching. And I found myself still thinking about this the next day in church. And I said, well, you know, it doesn't really matter where you set this. The important thing is pick a point and start in. So I said, fine, Scotland, 18th century. And that's where I began, knowing nothing about Scotland or the 18th century, having no plot, no outline, no characters, nothing but the rather vague images conjured up by the notion of a man in a kilt, which is, of course, a very powerful and compelling image. In fact, another digression alert here. The last book in the series, A Breath of Snow and Ashes, was a very lucky book for me. It opened at number one on the bestseller lists of four countries simultaneously, which is totally cool. Oh, thank you. Yes, I kind of don't think we'll be that lucky this time. What with Dan Brown clogging up the bestseller list? But, you know, nonetheless. And it also won a couple of literary prizes, including the Corina International Literary Prize for Fiction, which was totally cool. And I had to go to Berlin to accept this on German television, which was also cool. They had it in the German Opera House, and it's fairly funny. I was wearing my my best television clothes, which is long black chiffon pants, sort of an oriental coat over it made of silk with poppies and beads and things like that. It's very stylish. Anyway, the point here is that it's also also kind of long. Anyway, when we were going to go on, there were several people getting awards. They gave us each a little box to clip to our belts in the back or stick in our pockets if we were male, that came to our lapel mic so that we could make our acceptance speeches. And for those of us who weren't German speakers, they gave us another little box that had a little curly crew cue thing that went in your ear so you could hear the translation of what was being said. So I was last on the menu, and they held this in the Berlin State Opera House, which is an old antique place that's been beautifully restored, but they didn't restore the seats, or rather they didn't change the seats. They were these kind of made of wood with a bottom that just folds down, and you sit on this wooden platform for a while, squirming. And I was the last one on the menu for the evening, and they were filming everything, and I was, you know, kind of getting ready to get up and do my speech. Well, so they call my name. I stand up and start forward, only to realize that one of my boxes has fallen off and is wedged under the seat. You know? I'm tethered to it by this cord, so I'm standing there yanking on the cord. The television boom is dollying. I finally got it out, but I couldn't, you know, hike up my coat and stick it back in my pants on camera, so I was obliged to run up on stage holding the thing and hoping people would think it was my evening clutch. But what I started out to tell you here is that during the week when I was there, the German publisher had me interviewed by absolutely everybody in the German press, you know, everything from the equivalent of USA Today to Vanity Fair. And toward the end of the week, I was talking to this nice gentleman from one of their literary magazines, and he'd read all the books and was raving about them. He said, oh, you know, your narrative drive is marvelous, and your imagery is just wonderful, and your characters are so three-dimensional. And I'm thinking, yes, yes, go on. And instead he paused and he said, I'm just wondering, could you tell me what is the appeal of a man in a kilt? Well, he was a German, you know. And I was really tired, or I might not have said it, but I just looked at him for a minute and I said, well, I suppose it's the idea that you could be up against a wall with him in a minute. Well, so 3 weeks later, I'm home again, and I get a packet of press clippings from this little jaunt. I recognize this gentleman's name at the top. It was in German, which I can read, but slowly. But the publisher had put a post-it on top, and it said, I don't know what you told this man, but I think he is in love with you. As I say, a very powerful and compelling image. So, the only thing that I knew about writing novels at this point was that they should have conflict. And so I went immediately to the library and looked up Scotland Highlands 18th century. Well, here were 400 books about Scotland, and so I tiptoed along and took out anything that looked interesting and began looking for conflict in Scotland in the 18th century. Well, you don't do that for very long before you run smack into Charles Stuart and the Rising of the 45. So I said, okay, the Jacobite Rebellion looks like conflict. All right, we'll do that. I said, okay, now I must have a lot of Scotsmen, of course, because of the kilt factor. But I think it would be a good idea if I had a female character to kind of play off these guys. Then we'd have sexual tension. That's conflict. That's good. And so I said, well, you know, given that it's essentially Scots versus English, if I make her an English woman, we'll have lots of conflict. So about the third day of writing, I introduced this English woman. And I had no idea who she was, what she was doing there, or how she got into the story, but I just loosed her into a cottage full of Scotsmen to see what she'd do. Well, she walked in, they're all crouched around the hearth muttering to each other, and they turned around and stared at her. And I'm thinking, why does she look funny? What's going on here? Anyway, one of them drew himself up and he said, my name's Dougal Mackenzie, and who might you be? And without my stopping to think, I just typed, my name's Claire Elizabeth Beecham, and who the hell are you? And I said, well, you don't sound at all like an 18th century person. So I fought with her for several pages, trying to beat her into shape and make her talk like a historical person. But she wasn't having any of this. She just kept making smart-ass modern remarks. And she also took over and started telling the story herself. So I said, well, I'm not going to fight with you all the way through this book. I said, no one's ever going to see this. It doesn't matter what bizarre thing I do. I said, go ahead and be modern. I'll figure out how you got there later. So it's all her fault that there's time travel in these books. Caffeine. Yeah, so anyway, I kind of proceeded from this point, and at this point it stopped being a traditional historical novel. I mean, Doctor Who notwithstanding was a straightforward historical novel up until that point. But once you've decided that your main character is a time traveler, I mean, obviously anything goes. So obviously anything did, you know, including the Loch Ness Monster and a few other improbable things. So I was writing happily along. Well, going back to the freelance writing for the computer press, about a year before I started writing this novel, Byte Magazine had sent me a software package to review along with a membership to CompuServe. Now, this was the mid-80s, so this was long before the days of AOL or chat rooms or the World Wide Web as we know it. It was very rudimentary. But they did have a few big information services, including CompuServe, which had, you know, special interest support groups. And the software company had a special interest forum on the CompuServe to support their software. So Byte said, you know, we'd like you to check this out, mention it in your review. So I did. And then I had 4 hours of free connect time left. Well, this was back in the day when they charged you $30 an hour to be connected rather than giving you $7,000 free. And so I said, well, what else is in here? I'm not wasting $120. And so I began poking around, and I ran into the literary forum. Now, this was a bunch of people who liked books. It wasn't a writer's group as such, but there were some writers there, professional, aspiring, and a lot of readers, just people who like to talk about books and literature and all that. For someone with 2 full-time jobs and 3 small children, it was the ideal social life. So I promptly joined up and began hanging out there. Well, as I say, I'd been there for maybe a year before I began writing my own book, and I was not going to tell any of these people what I was doing either. I wasn't telling my own husband what I was doing. But I wasn't telling them because I'd seen way too many people come in and, you know, talk about something that they were planning to do, but they'd never actually write a word. And I said, I'm going to actually write something before I tell anybody what I'm doing, and also it would be good if I thought it was any good. So I just kept quiet. But about 6 months into the writing, I was working late one night and having an argument with a gentleman online about what it feels like to be pregnant. Well, you know, CompuServe, as I say, was not a chat room. It still isn't. We're now called the CompuServe Books and Writers Community, but it's the same place. It's a bulletin board system where you address a message to a given other person, and when they log on, they get their message. But anybody else can read the messages and reply to them, too, so you get interesting conversations. Well, so we were leaving messages for each other back and forth at half-hourly intervals. We were both working late and all that. And he said, oh, I know what that's like. My wife's had 3 children. And I laughed. And I said, yeah, Buster, I've had 3 children. He said, can you tell me what it's like then? I said, well, I can, yes. I said, but it's kind of complex. I don't know that I can fit it in a 30-line message slot. I said, I have this piece, though, that I wrote a few months ago in which a young woman explains to her brother what it's like to be pregnant in some detail. I said, I'll put it in the library and you can read it. So I did, and everyone who'd been following the argument went and read this piece. And they all came rushing back, and they said, well, this is cool. What is it? And I said, I don't know. And they said, well, where's the beginning? And I said, I haven't written that yet. And they said, well, put up some more of it. And so I don't write with an outline, and I don't write with a straight line. I write in bits and pieces where I can see things happening, and then gradually they form connections and join up. So I don't have chapters until the last thing before I send something to an editor. But I did have pieces. And so whenever I'd have 5 or 10 pages that would stand by itself without a lot of explanation, I'd put it in the library. And people kept reading my pieces, and they'd come back and say, oh, Diana has a new chunk. Have you read it? And they'd talk about it. And little by little, more people kept saying, well, this is cool. You should try and publish it. I said, I don't even know what kind of book it is, and I think you probably ought to know that, you know, but eventually I'm going to write a book I want to publish. So for the sake of argument, what should I do? Well, as I say, I did know a number of writers by this time, and they knew me. I wasn't some total stranger coming and saying, tell me the name of your agent. But I began asking them what to do, and they said, well, you should get an agent. They said, an agent can do 2 things for you. He or she can get your manuscript read much more quickly than you can do yourself. And if it does sell, then he or she can negotiate a much better contract than you can do, which is also true. Literary contracts are Byzantine things. My first one ran 12 pages of subclauses. And it's only owing to the skill of my first agent that I still own my t-shirt rights and my action figure rights. My husband says he can't wait to see the Black Jack Randall action figure. So I said, well, you know, that makes sense. How would I find an agent? They gave me advice. And anyway, I gradually began talking to people who had agents, you know, and zeroing in on this particular man named Perry Knowlton, who I thought might be a good match for me. He was a very well-known agent. He represented a lot of best-selling authors, including a few that I knew. And I'd also heard that he was not afraid of unorthodox books or of very long books, both of which it had dawned on me I had. So I thought he'd be a good match. But I didn't know how to approach him because he didn't take unsolicited queries. And I thought, well, you're not finished writing the book, you know, just go on asking questions. Either you'll figure out how to get at him or you'll find someone who's easier. So I did. And one day I was talking to a friend named John Stith, who writes science fiction mysteries. And I said, well, I'm asking everybody about agents, John. Do you have one? He said, well, yeah. He said, by coincidence, it's the same as so-and-so. His name is Perry Knowlton. He said, I know you're almost ready to look for your own agent. Would you like me to introduce you to Perry? I said, well, that'd be really nice, John. I was afraid that John would leave CompuServe or be run over by a bus before I finished the book. So I said, yes, go ahead, ask him. And so he wrote just a regular typewriter and paper note to Perry. Perry was a charming older gentleman, no longer with us, alas, who I'm sure never touched a computer in his life. And so this was just, you know, a straightforward note, as though I had met John at a cocktail party, which in essence I did. It was just an electronic cocktail party. Anyway, I followed this with my own query letter, and I said, dear Mr. Knowlton, I've been writing and selling nonfiction by myself for some years now, but now that I'm writing a novel, I understand I need good literary representation, and, you know, you've been recommended to me by John and Judy and all these people whose opinions I respect. I said, I have this very long historical novel. I don't want to waste your time. Would you be willing to read excerpts from it? I didn't tell him I wasn't through writing it. Excerpts were all I had. But but he very kindly called back and said, yes, he'd read my excerpts. So I hastily wrote a 26-page single-spaced synopsis and sent it with my bundle of excerpts, and he took me on the basis of an unfinished first novel, which was not usual then, and is probably even less usual now, but it was very lucky. Well, 6 months later, I finally finished the book, and I sent it to Perry, and I called to tell him it was coming and said, well, I'll be in New York next week myself for a scientific conference, and he said, oh, come up to the office, you know, we can meet, because we'd never met face-to-face. We'd just done all our business over the phone. So the next week, I'm in New York. I go up to see Perry in some trepidation of mind, because at this point, he was the only person in the world who'd read the whole book, and I didn't yet know what he thought of it. So anyway, as I say, he turned out to be a charming older gentleman, took me back to his office and was chatting, trying to put me at my ease. It didn't quite have the effect that he hoped, because it was at this point I realized that in addition to my friends on CompuServe, he also represented Tony Hillerman, Frederick Forsyth, and Robertson Davies, as well as the estate of Ayn Rand. And I was sitting there thinking, if you have the nerve to call Robertson Davies Robbie, you're a better man than I am. But but what was most unnerving was that he had my manuscript sitting on the desk in front of him in the big orange box in which I'd shipped it. And I was convinced that at some point he was going to say, well, now that I've read the whole thing, I think it's just too weird. You know, there's nothing I can do with it, but, you know, keep me in mind. So I was expecting to hear this at any moment. Instead, he said, you know, the thing about Freddie Forsyth and Robbie Davies and those guys is that they're all great storytellers. And then he laid a hand on the box and smiled at me and said, and you're another one. Thank you. Well, at this point, I was so gratified, I didn't care what he did with it, but I did gather enough sense to ask, and he said, well, I'm sending it out today to 5 editors who I think might like it. You know, he explained to me who they all were and what he thought the chances of each was and all that, and I said, well, that sounds great. You know, how long do you think we might have to wait for an answer? Because I'd been reading Writer's Market, and you know, they say, you know, 18 months, 2 years to get an answer from an editor, and that's what I was expecting. And instead, he said, well, I've told them all I want an answer in 30 days, and I'm thinking, boy, you picked the right agent. So... So I went home to wait for 30 days. Well, instead, 4 days later, I get a call from Perry on my answering machine saying, this is Perry, I've just called to update you on your manuscript. And so I was sure that of the 5 he sent it to, at least one was saying, here, I'm not reading a 10-pound book, take it back. And so I called up to hear that, and instead he said, well, of the 5 I sent it to, so far 3 of them have called back with offers. So he was able to negotiate amongst them for 2 weeks and emerged with a 3-book contract. And bing, I was a novelist. Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, so that brings us along to the new book, Echo in the Bone, which I see many of you are clutching. I'm very pleased to hear that. That's great. In fact, we did the launch party for this book last night in Scottsdale, where I live. We had to hold it at a hotel ballroom because we couldn't fit all the people into the bookstore, which is substantially smaller than this one. But we had over 700 people at the launch party, and with the pre-orders and that, we sold 2,600 copies of the book yesterday. Thank you. I certainly appreciate the support. And my editor emailed me this morning and said, well, you know, Barnes & Noble reported sales of 17,000 copies for the chain yesterday. So, yeah, well, that's pretty good, yeah. Well, at least I think so, yeah. I wrote back to him. I said, well, I haven't got any basis for comparison, but that sounds good. And he said, well, it's about 60% more than the first day sales of Breath of Snow and Ashes, which, as I say, did open at number one on the bestseller lists of four countries. So we're doing well. Thank you. We appreciate it. Yeah. Anyway, as you can see from looking at this, this has a great cover. They, you know, if your books start selling, they actually start asking you what you want on your covers. And luckily, we're to that level now. And so I told them I wanted a caltrop, which is what that thing on the cover is. Now, in case you have not seen a caltrop recently, that's an ancient military weapon. The old Romans used to use it to throw on the ground to deter cavalry coming toward them. And the modern-day highway patrol still uses it at barricades to cripple speeding cars. It works just as well on tires as it does on hooves. You take a handful of those things, and you know nothing is coming toward you at a high rate of speed anymore. Anyway, the important point here is that you have four tines on a caltrop, so that whichever way you throw it, one point is always sticking up. Well, there are four storylines in this book. Okay, one of those is, of course, Jamie and Claire's, because, I mean, this is Jamie and Claire's series, even though there are other people involved by this time. And we left them at the end of A Breath of Snow and Ashes, more or less on their way to Scotland. And at least Jamie is announcing he wants to go to Scotland to buy, or to get back his printing press, which he left there in Voyager. Now, I have had people to whom I've said this say, well, why doesn't he just get a printing press in the U.S.? I said, well, you know, A, it wasn't the U.S. at that point, you know, and B, you heard of the American Revolution. Any idea why we fought that one? It was partly because England bought raw materials from the colonies, but would not allow the colonies to manufacture anything. You even had to buy paper from England because they wouldn't let you make it in the colonies unless you were making it, you know, individually by hand. But there were no paper mills, there were no smelters, there were no foundries, there were, you know, no factories of any kind. And even ironmongery like spades and hoes and things had to be shipped from England. Ditto printing presses. Therefore, if Jamie wants a printing press, he's either going to have to mug someone who already has one, or he's going to have to go back to Scotland and get his. However, he has other reasons for wanting to go to Scotland. One of those is that he promised his sister that he would bring her youngest son back. And so he thinks this may be his last chance to get young Ian to Scotland before all hell breaks loose in the revolution, since he knows what's coming. He's informed young Ian that he's going to Scotland, whether on his feet or tied in a sack. But he's going. He has a less spoken motive, though, one that he confides, you know, only to Claire, and that only briefly, which is that he doesn't want to face his son across the barrel of a gun. You know, he knows that William, his illegitimate son and his unacknowledged son, is in the colonies as a young lieutenant in the British Army. And, you know, what are the odds that eventually they're going to run into each other in some very hostile situation? He'd rather that didn't happen. And so he wants to go to Scotland. So as to whether they make it to Scotland and what happens to them on the way, you'll have to read the book. But luckily you don't have to wait anymore. The second storyline here is Roger and Brianna's. We left them at the end of A Breath of Snow and Ashes at Lallybroch with a casket of Jamie and Claire's letters to read. So they are, in fact, reading those letters slowly, you know, savoring the connection with their kinfolk and all that. At the same time, they're sort of struggling with their own issues of settling back into modern life. You know, is Roger still got a vocation as a Presbyterian minister? You know, is Brianna going to settle down as a housewife? I don't think so. And, you know, and how are their children going to adjust? Meanwhile, they are becoming gradually aware that the highlands of the 20th century aren't any safer than the highlands of the 18th century. And I will leave you with that thought. The third storyline is that of Lord John Grey and his stepson William, who is, of course, Jamie Fraser's natural son. Well, we see from their side, the English or the British side of the American Revolution, it actually was a war with two sides, or three if you want to count the French. And usually we only see the American side, but there actually was an English side, and we will get to see some of the fighting as well as the politics from that side. Now, Lord John is, of course, a career soldier. He's also been a career diplomat and, less spoken of, a career spy. So he's kind of got it all going on. Willie, meanwhile, knows more or less what his stepfather has been up to all his life, admires him, would like to emulate him. It's a military family. He joined the army without question, but right now he's sort of torn between the enticements of battle. You know, he's never been in a battle. He's kind of wondering, with a sort of queasy excitement, what it will be like when he finally has to kill someone. And he's kind of drawn to that. At the same time, he's drawn to the charms of intelligencing. You know, spying was vulgar. A gentleman wouldn't do that. But if the gentleman happened to be writing by something interesting, he could take notes, and tell a superior officer about it. That was intelligencing, and that was fine. So he's kind of trying to decide what his role in this conflict is. Okay, and the fourth storyline here is young Ian's. So we will get to know more about his Indian wife and find out what happens there. And does he ever go to Scotland? And if he does, what happens then? So anyway, the thing to note here is that no matter which way you throw a caltrop, one end is always pointing up. And you'll notice that every single point on that is sharp. You have been warned. You have been warned, especially not to skip ahead in this book. It's not that there's any horrifying revelation at the end. It's that if you do that, you will encounter probably more than one thing, which will shock you, but you won't understand what it actually means unless you have led up to it, because you won't have the context for it. Yeah, so don't do that. normally I would stop and ask questions, but we have so many people here tonight, I'm not sure that we can do it very effectively. I wonder if you would like me to read you a short bit from Echo and the Bone before we sign your books. Thanks. And you should certainly feel free to ask me questions when you come up to have your book signed. Oh, and before I forget to say, it's perfectly okay if you have pictures taken, too. Or if you just want to take pictures of me by myself. Totally fine, too. Great. Okay, well, this is a short piece from Echo and the Bone. At this point, the Frasers are still in North Carolina. It's winter, of course, and they can't travel because the passes are choked with snow, and they've been waiting for months for them to melt, which they're finally doing. The spring thaw has come, and Clara's out in the creek gathering watercress because they haven't got any green stuff over the winter, and she's dying for salad, so she's picking watercress. While she's doing this, she hears shrieks and yells coming from up the creek, and going to investigate, she discovers that the gentlemen of the household are taking their spring bath. So she pauses to enjoy the spectacle, and after a while sees Jamie, get out and take his leave of the others and go off up the path with his plaid wrapped loosely around himself. And so she goes to put away her basket of watercress and then goes to follow him. I waved briefly and turned up the side trail that led to the upper clearing. New house, everyone called it, though the only indications that there might someday be a house there were a stack of felled logs and a number of pegs driven into the ground with strings tied between them. These were meant to mark the placement and dimensions of the house Jamie intended to build in replacement of the big house when we came back. He'd been moving the pegs, I saw. The wide front room was now wider, and the back room intended for my surgery had developed a growth of some sort, perhaps a separate still room. The architect was sitting on a log, surveying his kingdom, stark naked. "Expecting me, were you?" I asked, taking off my shawl and hanging it on a convenient branch. "I was." He smiled and scratched his chest. "I thought the sight of my naked backside would likely inflame you." "But was it maybe Bobby's?" "Bobby hasn't got one. Do you know, you haven't got a single gray hair below the neck. Why is that, I wonder?" He glanced down, inspecting himself, but it was true. There were only a few strands of silver among the fiery mass of his hair, though his beard, the winter growth tediously and painfully removed a few days before, was heavily frosted with white. But the hair on his chest was still a dark auburn, and that below a fluffy mass of vivid ginger. He combed his fingers thoughtfully through the exuberant foliage, looking down. "I think it's hiding," he remarked. And glanced up at me, one eyebrow raised. "Want to come and help me hunt for it?" I came round in front of him and obligingly knelt down. The object in question was in fact quite visible, though admittedly looking rather shell-shocked by the recent immersion, and a most interesting shade of pale blue. "Well," I said, after a moment's contemplation, "great oaks from tiny acorns grow." A shiver ran through him at the warmth of my mouth, and I lifted my hands involuntarily, cradling his balls. Holy God, he said, and his hands rested lightly on my head in benediction. What did you say? He asked a moment later. I said, coming up momentarily for air, I find the goose flesh rather erotic. That's more where that came from, he assured me. Take your shift off, Sassenach. I haven't seen you naked in nearly 6 months. Well, no, you haven't, I agreed, hesitating. I'm not sure I want you to. One eyebrow went up. Why ever not? Because I've been indoors for weeks on end without sun or exercise to speak of. I probably look like one of those grubs you find under rocks, fat, white, and squidgy. Squidgy, he repeated, breaking into a grin. Squidgy, I said with dignity, wrapping my arms round myself. He pursed his lips and exhaled slowly, eyeing me with his head on one side. I like it when you're fat, but I can't quite well that you're not, he said, because I felt your ribs when I put my arms about you each night since the end of January. As for white, you've been white all the time I've known you. It's no likely to come a great shock to me. As for the squidgy part, he extended one hand and wiggled the fingers beckoningly at me. I think I might enjoy that. I said, still hesitant. He sighed. Sassenach, he said. I said, I've not seen you naked in 6 months. That means if you take your shift off now, you'll be the best thing I've seen in 6 months. And at my age, I didn't think I'd remember farther back than that. I laughed and without further ado stood up and pulled the ribbon tie at the neck of my shift. Wriggling, I let it fall in a puddle round my feet. He closed his eyes, then breathed deep and opened them again. I'm blinded, he said softly, and held out a hand to me. Blinded, as in sun bouncing off a vast expanse of snow, I asked dubiously, or as in coming face to face with a gorgon. Seeing a gorgon turns you to stone, not strikes you blind, he informed me. Though come to think, he prodded himself with an experimental forefinger. I may turn to stone yet. Will you come here, for God's sake? I came. Thank you very much. Thanks a lot. Yeah, it does occur to me that I probably should answer the two or three most commonly asked questions just to save you all asking them. Yes, there is still a movie option in effect. No, there isn't any further news on it. They've had a script written and are shopping for a director if and when they find one. I'm sure they'll tell me, in which case I'll tell you. I've recently updated the website so it has more current information and we'll announce it there if and when. And to answer the next question, no, I have absolutely no idea who could play Jamie Fraser. You all probably know much better than I do. But if you do look at the website, there is a link there to a YouTube channel that a kindly person put together for me, on which she has collected all of the casting videos that people have uploaded to YouTube. These are everybody's ideas. Though she wouldn't upload any of the ones that suggested Sandra Bullock should play Claire. She says she's not having any of that. Yeah. And there is a very strong lobby for the Gerard Butler should be Jamie. To which all I can say is he is a Scot, even though a lowlander, and he is a very fine-looking man. On the other hand, I can't see him playing a 22-year-old virgin. So, you know, we'll just have to wait and see what happens there. And, the next question. No, this is not the last book. There is another one after this. Well, I'm glad you feel that way about it. And to answer the next question, no, I haven't the slightest idea when it will be out. I finished writing this book approximately a month ago, thanks to the wonders of printing technology these days. I finished it a month ago. It went to press 3 weeks ago, shipped 2 weeks ago, and here we all are tonight. And a good thing, too. Yeah. So thank you very much for coming, and I will be delighted to sign any books that you happen to have on your persons. Thanks.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.